Joel Stransky, former Springbok, he's a director at Pivotal Capital. When do you actually get time to work? You do Cape Epics, yep. You do Ironmans, you spend your weekends jabbering on about rugby on TV, and then you're supposed to run a company during the week.
I think my partners would ask the same question, actually.
Sorry, how awkward.
Yeah, so we do, you know, we ride early and we try and fit it all in, but I must say it's at times it is but tiring, and I think probably my wife gets the brunt of it, because I think most evenings I get home and about half past eight I'm ready to go to bed like a really old man.
But now listen, Pivotal Capital, what you up to? The last time I spoke to you, you were doing all kinds of things like headhunting, yeah, using data and matching people with jobs in the ether.
It is, and it's ongoing. It's one of our businesses in that sort of AI data analytics space around and recruitment, career guidance, career management, really understanding an individual properly and matching them to a job or a future job. And quite interesting listening to your chats earlier about, you know, AI coming in and whether, yeah, human beings will still have jobs in years to come.
You're working on this technology, yeah, for jobs that won't exist
to make ourselves redundant. Yeah, exactly. But I think the jobs will just become more sophisticated. So someone will need to manage the robots.
Somebody have to oil them.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Or whatever you do to
exactly.
robots. But life is good.
Life is good. Yeah, other businesses are going along nicely. There's good traction in the voice biometric space for us, which is wonderful. And in the connectivity, the hosted telephony side, call centers will, you know, there'll always be a need for someone to talk to someone. And
yeah, but voice biometrics, it's the whole thing is your voice is unique. Yours, yep, is particularly unique. People will recognize
it. Well, they recognize it in the rugby world.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't they?
Yeah. But it's that voice. So when you phone a call center and you want to log into your bank account and get some help in the bank, your voice activated, so you don't have to remember numbers and stuff.
100%. And I think it's a matter of convenience, but more importantly, it's that customer experience. You don't want to be asked 20 questions to verify who you are. You want to go through a quick, simple, easy process, get the service, and make your transaction.
And when one day somebody's going to take your rugby commentary and chop it up into little bits.
And criticize it properly. And then I'm going to go back to the mirror and think, oh my goodness, what am I doing there?
They might just do that. Now listen, you became very famous, 1995 Rugby World Cup around that time. You then went and you went into the UK and you were going to be at Bristol Rugby as a coach.
Well, I was.
What went wrong?
It did go wrong.
Aren't you glad?
Yes and no. And I say it went wrong, and it was horrible to be involved in something that went that horribly wrong. It went wrong for a very simple reason. I was going to be the head coach. Bob Dwyer was the director of rugby. He had a fallout with the CEO of the club, and in the fallout, I was the consequence. And so they reneged on the contract, and it was messy. We went to court, and you know, high court in the UK is not for the faint-hearted. It was the grey wigs and the whole story. It was a very stressful period. But at the end of the day, why I say I'm not sure if it was a good or a bad thing. It was good in the sense that I'm very happy with where I am right now. But part of me would probably like to have been a professional rugby coach and to have pursued more of a coaching career. And I, at that point, decided that, you know what, if your fate and destiny is not in your hands and someone else can do that to you, then maybe it's not a career I want to embark on. But in retrospect, as I said, I'm very happy where I am, but rugby's part of my DNA.
Yeah, but your life was rugby, and rugby was your life, and you were, yeah, rugby and everything else. And it was a beautiful time to be in global rugby. Yet it caused a switch. And it caused a switch out of coaching,
yeah,
and into business.
And for all the right reasons, you know, and if I think back on that period, there were moments where it was tough and there were moments where I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. But what did transpire is I met some wonderful people and had some great mentors in life, in business, learned enormously, and embarked on a corporate career, which, you know, put me on the path to where I am today. So I should really not complain.
Were you guys paid in 1995 to play in that World Cup? Were you professionals?
We were not paid. If I tell you how much we were paid when we won the World Cup, you will fall over. We were paid 100,000 rand, I think it was, from which they deducted the cost of every ticket that we were given. So I think we got about 90 grand in cash. It came out of a fund, and I think we were taxed on it anyway.
No doubt. Maybe the game has changed fundamentally since, yeah, those times. You weren't playing rugby for the money in those days. You were playing it for the glory and the glory that you got.
And for the love of the game. You know, I think, yeah, the glory was a consequence of the love of the game.
Sure.
And And we were just, you know, I'm often asked about the political side of particularly that era with Madiba and the change. And, but for us, we were just, to your point, we were a bunch of young rugged players, mainly white at that time, mm-hmm. but young rugged players from different cultures, different backgrounds. We just wanted to run on the field and play the game we loved and do, to the best of our ability.
Did you grow up with money in the house? Where did you grow up? What's the backstory?
No, so we grew up in Cape Town in a, you know, we were three boys and my parents in a small three bedroom house. My dad, you know, worked his butt off. And
what did he do?
Well, he worked initially for Clicks. He was a buyer for Clicks in the real early days. I think we got by. And we never wanted for anything. We always had rugby boots and cricket bats and
the important stuff in life.
The important things, yeah. So you know, we could never complain about our upbringing, but it certainly wasn't a spoiled upbringing.
Mm.
But the values were important.
But you got a good schooling at Rondebosch, and then you went to Maritzburg Boys.
Yeah.
So you had your really decent schooling, which was helpful. And then did you go on to university after that?
I did. I went to Maritzburg and switched to Durban, and the travel between Maritzburg and the Sharks training facility was a little much, three nights a week. And ultimately, that's probably one big regret I do have, is that I'd never finished my degree. I gave up to go and play rugby more professionally and put some cash in the bank, which, you know, in retrospect, it is the one thing if I could go back, I would most certainly change.
Yeah, and at the time, I mean, why would you have passed up an opportunity to play rugby?
Exactly.
And especially at such an exciting time for South Africa, coming out of isolation and being able to play on a world stage.
Yeah, very much so. And to go and travel and tour and see the world, because it wasn't just about, you know, the professional game. It was also about living in Italy and living in France and experiencing different cultures, different lifestyles, learning about the game, learning about different attitudes towards the game. And all of that made me a much better player and probably a much better person. But it is that lingering, you know, question mark.
What were you studying, for interest?
I was doing a BCom.
Okay.
And probably more with the admin marketing type slant. But it's pointless worrying about it anymore.
No, I mean, has it held you back not having a formal education?
I don't think it has, actually. I think it probably holds me back because it, deep down inside, it's the regret I have more so than anything else. But you know, I learned the basics. I had some great mentors when I came out of rugby and into the corporate world and learned about business and how to manage big businesses. And, you know, I got given a bit of a step up once or twice, maybe because of my rugby reputation.
Sure.
I'll be quite honest and
if you know
about
people,
that.
You know people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if you can open doors and you can, you know, you can help the cause, then why not? So, you know, and the one thing around that I did learn is that if you surround yourself by people who can do what you can't do, they'll make you look good eventually.
Yeah, that's the one secret people tell me is precisely that. Know what other people are good at and let them do it.
Exactly.
And just make sure that they stick to the rules. Just having a look at the currency this evening, the rand is trending stronger tonight. Dollar-rand exchange rate, 11.90. It's about a percentage point stronger on the day. To the pound, we're at 16.44 and to the euro at 14.60. As currency markets await a change in politics in South Africa. We watch and we wait. Joel Stransky is our guest this evening. He is a director at Pivotal Capital. You will know him from his rugby days. You'll know him from Supersport, where he works over weekends, in addition to what should be a day job. But this is a guy who goes and does the Cape Epic. He does Ironman events. He's done one full Ironman event. His colleagues at the office don't know what he looks like. They catch up with him on weekends, watching him on TV. More with him in a
piece.
Joel Stransky is my guest this evening. So, who determined what money would be spent on in the home when you grew up?
Well, I think Dad. I think Dad earned the money. Dad decided how it would be spent.
And he knew where all the deals were.
And he knew where he hid the money, most importantly, I think.
Oh, did he keep cash? Did he keep a cash stash?
Well, I think so. I think it was an era of, you know, a different way of growing up. And I think cash was still king then, wasn't it?
My grandfather, apparently, and I only know this from family legend, used to keep cash behind paintings in his house. So, he would store cash, bundles of cash all over the place. And when he died, family members went around feeding behind the paintings. But
that was all gone by then.
I think somebody else had got
there first. I think in our house, three boys going to school, wanting cricket bats, rugby boots, all those things. I don't think there was much cash left.
Yeah. No, but I mean, but you didn't ever feel that there was a desperate shortage of cash. It wasn't huge comfort, but you had a nice middle-class upbringing.
We had a proper middle class upbringing. We got a great education. We went to good schools. We, as I said, we wanted for nothing. We grew up in a loving home, and we got the values. You know, I started saying that earlier. My parents were were very value oriented. You know, they instilled in us the values that have made all three of us successful in our own way and certainly upstanding citizens.
Did you have to work at all? Did your mom and dad send you out to go and do any kind of job?
Well, not a job. I think we all had chores. We all had to clean up the dog mess and clean the windows and, you know, fix what we broke because we broke things in our house.
The three boys in the house.
The three boys, yeah. Clean the walls when we fought, you know, all those things. But we never had to work. And I think probably if my mum and dad were sitting here today, they would probably say they were a bit lucky with me because from the day I left school, I got rugby bursaries. And I went to the Air Force first, but bursaries and scholarships and money. And so from the day I left school, they never had to support me, but they certainly had to fund my brothers through varsity. And you know, don't listen to all those people out there who say when your kids leave private schooling, it's a blessing because varsity is even more expensive. Don't worry.
No, it's absolutely nuts. I mean, so rugby was your first paying job. It wasn't a brilliant paying job, but you earned a living playing rugby?
No. So when I grew up, I mean, rugby was completely amateur. We got a couple of $100 a game, you know, and we didn't know how to spend that money at the time because it was so much, it was really beer money. So my first paying job was, 1 year I worked in a little sports shop. When I say this, you're going to say, yeah, you're an accident prone buddy bugger. I fell off my surfboard and cut my foot and ended up in hospital for a couple of weeks with septicemia. So I ended up missing some exams and having to start the varsity year again. So I worked in a little sports shop for about 6 months. That was my first real pay job. It was fantastic.
Were you any good at it?
I was dreadful, but because I trashed all the sports equipment. My mates used to come around. We'd play hockey with all the hockey sticks. We'd kick the balls around. It was amazing. We could never sell anything after we played with it.
Yeah. No, and you lasted 6 months in that paying job. First proper paying job?
Well, probably rugby. Really,
okay. When did that become when could you exist playing rugby?
96.
So that's 1995. You win the Rugby World Cup. Where are you in 96 being earning a living playing rugby?
So I'm down in Cape Town playing for Western Province. Part of that whole transition, which, you know, it wasn't always an easy transition. There were players' unions and all sorts of drama. And, you know, I mean, remember I suggested to the coach at the time, Andre Markgraaf, that the players needed representation on their finances. And, you know, a week later, I was out the squad. You know, maybe I didn't play all that well either, but it was a period of transition and it was a period where, you know, the players who put their hands up and were part of that, you know, came under a bit of pressure, which meant for Francois, for myself, for a couple of us who went overseas in 97 to play in the UK, it was just a wonderful relief to go and play the game we loved and get paid to do it.
Again, then getting paid properly to do it as well.
Well, nicely. I wouldn't say properly. I think the guys today are paid properly, but we got paid nicely.
I mean, do you think when you look at professional sport now, has it lost some of the magic?
I think the cynics out there might say that. I don't think so. I think it's got a different magic to it now. It might not have that amateur magic to it. It might not have, you know, maybe some of the fun elements of going out and having 25 beers after the game and, you know, letting your hair down properly and maybe, you know, letting off some real steam. I think that's gone, but that's gone because players now understand their bodies a little bit better. They understand what's required, what you can put in, when to put it in, what not to put in the case of, you know, too much alcohol. Yeah. So I think that element is gone, but I think the camaraderie is still there. The team sport element is still there. You know, the giving everything and bleeding and, you know, coming off the field battered and bruised and celebrating together or commiserating together. Yeah. That still exists. And that's what makes team sport so unbelievably attractive to all of us.
What are you good with money?
I'm not bad. I mean, I think I wouldn't say I'm good. I've made some, you know, errors along the way.
Tell me about those.
Maybe trusted one or two people I shouldn't have. And who? As a result, I trusted a bloke in the UK with the money we earned. He's in jail.
Oh, is he?
No, the money's gone. He's in jail. So
I mean, what was an investment scheme or what was it?
Yeah, it was a couple of investment schemes. He managed it, got me into, in fact, one was a bit of a Ponzi scheme, I think, which went under. One was a bad property. So he, you know, his legacy for me is catastrophic. So, you know, since then I've been a little bit more cynical.
Did you lose a substantial amount of money?
Yeah, I lost a chunk.
A chunk. Oh, that's a lot.
A chunk.
Yeah. A chunk is a lot. Did you chunk?
At the time I chunked, yeah, yes. Properly.
No, but I mean, as brutal as that is, and as horrible as that must have been at the time, I mean, your UK experience, you Bristol, you get nailed, and then you invest money with a guy who takes your cash.
So fortunately, it wasn't all the cash.
No.
So, and so it depends on your attitude. You know, if you're willing, if you're a person who risks a little in with someone you maybe don't know as well as you ought to have got to know them, or you don't haven't investigated or Googled them as much as
it didn't
you
exist.
It didn't exist. But on this, in the same breath, I invested in one or two other schemes where I've done unbelievably well. So, you know, if I was somewhere in the middle and hadn't invested with him, I might not have invested where I've done well. Sure. I might be somewhere neutral anyway. So you take the good with the bad.
So worst money decision was trusting a guy you didn't know well enough, and you chunked with a chunk of money.
Yeah.
Best money decision?
So I think where I sit right now, I'd like to think that leaving corporate life was hugely risky.
Because you went Altec and it hurts.
I was at Altec and then with the Steinhoff Group.
Ah, well, yes,
that could have been a lot worse.
Could have. You could have switched your PEP shares for Steinhoff shares.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and then bailed at some point and lost a couple of billion. I think from a lifestyle perspective, from a, you know, living life, from an enjoyment perspective, when I left corporate life, life changed for me. It became very different in terms of the risk. And I don't think I've had a salary increase since I left. I don't think I've had a bonus or a dividend.
Well, you are the boss.
We've chucked every cent we've got back into the business, and we've thrown a lot of money at the problem. And I'd like to think we've built something unbelievably special. And at some point in the next 3 to 5 years, we'll cash out and we'll have done very nicely. But most importantly, our lifestyles as our shareholders and partners are fantastic. We don't sign leave forms. We still do watch our kids play sport at school. We go on holiday when we want to go on holiday.
You ride your bike. I ride my bike twice.
I do Ironman. Well, I haven't done Ironman for a little while now because I've been epic focused. But I go and ride, and ultimately, you know, my life is probably a little more relaxed and a little bit better. And most importantly, you know what they say, happy wife, happy life. I think my wife enjoys this job much more than she enjoyed the corporate job.
And you're responsible to yourselves rather than to face the shareholders as well, which is, I think, an advantage.
It is, but it comes with its own challenges. Sure. You know, at the end of the month, when you look at cash flow and you think, oh my goodness, how are we going to pay salaries this month? You know, that's a different challenge where that bloke is facing shareholders. He's never felt that. No. He or she's never felt that. There's always corporate money behind, and there's always some way of doing it. You know, for us, it's a little different.
Do you have extravagances other than bicycles? And cleats and things like that?
No, it's bicycles. It's definitely just the bicycles and all those accessories, the cleats, the power.
What's the most you've ever spent on a bicycle?
I could never tell you that. My wife would hear. No, so I think the other benefit of having kicked a drop goal.
She's just going through the bag statements now. You know that. She's at home. She's switched off the radio.
She's standing in the garage, hands on hips, looking at those bicycles, going, which one am I going to sell first? I think the benefit of having kicked a drop goal and having, you know, had a sports career is that, and having built a little bit of a brand, is that every now and then someone wants to give me something to use.
Slips you a bike.
Yeah, and I have a wonderful deal right now with an unbelievable bike manufacturer that makes my life very, very pleasant.
As long as you don't face plant again, you'll be fine. It wasn't the bike spot, I'm sure.
No, it wasn't. But, you know, face planting is part of biking. You know, we raced on the weekend and I had a little face plant. So it happens. You know, sometimes you come off worse for wears, and most of the time you get up and get back on.
If money was no object, what one thing would you do?
I would ride my bike more in different parts of the world. You know, last year I went and rode a little bit in the Alps. I think there is spectacular riding and experiences, and particularly mountain bike.
Would you follow the Tour de France?
I would follow it for a few days. It's just such a spectacular event, and I think it helps that Chris Froome is someone I've ridden with and I'm quite friendly with. So I would, but it wouldn't be my ultimate goal. I think the ultimate goal would be to get on my bike and go places that most people don't go, that I can go and enjoy and take my wife and family with.
Joel Stransky this evening on The Money Show, Make Money Monday special edition. Former Springbok director at Pivotal Capital nowadays, and spends too much money, yes, Mrs. Stransky, on bicycles.